Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:38, and that is Pacific Standard Time. And this being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio for the various different asset classes. Well, if we look at what's been happening this week, then by and large, stock markets rallied for the majority of the week. And that's because they were really oversold at this time last week, having pulled back very sharply. So a little bit of unwinding of the short-term oversold condition has taken place. And markets were generally a little bit easier in here today, but they held on to the majority of their gains. So you know, in here today, the DAX in Europe was down about 0.8%. Both Spain and Italy down a bit more than that. But the Dow and the S&P were pretty much unchanged. Then the bond markets. Well, this time last week, the futures markets and bonds were at really quite extraordinary levels. It had accelerated to peaks, and they pulled back for the majority of the week, but rallied yesterday and improved a little bit on that today, but closed off their highs. So, say the long bond is in the US is closing out the week at about 166, just a little bit less than a half. So, then this is about the area where if selling pressure is going to return, then you'd expect it to occur around this level. And with stock markets a little bit easier the last couple of days, then if the rally is going to be extended, then it should continue from here. Well, if we had some strength in bonds and a little bit of easing in stock markets, then it's the strength of the yen is perhaps the thing that is sticking out like a sore thumb when I click through the markets. Every day I run a macro on Bloomberg and I look at approximately 180 charts of stocks, bonds, currencies, and commodities. And that's just about every stock market index. It's every commodity that's traded. It's lots of fixed income futures and lots of currency pairs. And some of the things that stood out today was the yen, for certain, the Korean won, and the Thai market. So what could possibly tie the three of those together? And then let's just ruminate on that for a moment. The yen has strengthened today. It was stronger by 0.6 of 1 yen against the dollar. It's back down to 112 and two-thirds. And that's above the low that the dollar had formed against the yen back on the 11th. So the dollar then had rallied, and that coincided with some firmness in stock markets. Well, the Japanese, they have a vested interest in a weaker currency. They've got a central bank that has got an unabashed mandate to court inflation. And they haven't been particularly successful with it just yet. And they need wage growth, and wage demands have been coming in below expectations. So they have been fully engaged quantitative easing, and that's unlikely to change. One of the things that did happen last week, or maybe it was earlier this week, was that the central bank pulled back from giving the pension fund, the largest pension fund in the world, the option to invest directly in stocks. And that is something that is acting as a headwind for Japanese stocks generally, because there was a widely held anticipation that the Japanese pension fund would be able to invest in stocks, and now that's looking much less likely. But getting back to the yen, in previous audios, I've regarded it as a barometer for risk. And with the BOJ and the Japanese government so intent on getting the currency lower, why on earth is it rallying so impressively? And of course, it's because it was the carry trade currency of choice. And with high yield bonds in what we're seeing, spreads widen out and absolute yields for high yield US dollar denominated high yield debt upwards of about 10% now, and they haven't been at that level in quite a number of years. So there's definitely stress in the high yield sector, and we're in a much more volatile environment for stocks. So then the whole basis for a carry trade is that you borrow money that you anticipate the currency is going to go down so that you have to pay back less. You take the money that you're getting for almost nothing and invest it in a higher yielding instrument. Well, high yield, which, and despite the fact that the yields in high yield for a long time were not particularly high, you are moving further out the risk parameter to capture an additional yield. Well, they're falling now. And if you were long of those, you'd have to sell, and then you have to repurchase your yen, and that contributes to yen strength. And that's why the yen is a barometer for risk, because if you're closing out a carry trade investment, then you have to repurchase your yen, and it drives the yen higher. So the ability of the dollar to find support here at a progressively higher level will really be a great indication to us as to just how likely it is that stocks generally are going to be able to find support above their lows. Well, then what has that got to do with the Korean won? Well, the Koreans, they need a weaker currency too. And that's particularly poignant for Japan, because Japan and Korea compete in many of the same export markets. And the Korean won has been among the strongest currencies in the region now for a number of years. But the dollar broke out against it this week. And it has some of the most well-defined base formation characteristics of any asset class. So you would need some significant deterioration to really question the potential for the dollar to outperform here, and not just over the short term, but potentially into the medium term as well. Well, if the yuan is going to be getting weaker, then the competitiveness of the Korean stock market is likely to improve, and the underperformance of companies like Samsung or Kia or Hyundai is probably going to improve. And you can imagine that the trade ministry in Seoul would have had their phone ringing off the hook from the CEOs of those companies, saying how uncompetitive they were because the strength of the currency was so high. So it's looking increasingly likely that regardless of what any other central bank is doing, the Koreans are going after a currency devaluation. Well, if that is the case, and the Japanese market isn't doing particularly well, then you have to start looking around for currencies that are less likely to engage in outright devaluation, and Indonesia is certainly one of those. The central bank moved in to support the currency last summer, and the currency has been among the most stable in the region since. And then in both in nominal and in US dollar terms or foreign currency terms, the stock market has been among the better performers. And Thailand is also part of that small group. The baht has been somewhat more stable over the last few months. It hasn't experienced the same kind of upward dynamic that the Indonesian rupiah has, but then the stock market is responding both in nominal and foreign currency terms. So that's potentially encouraging, because we're starting to see some of the high-growth ASEAN countries beginning to exhibit relative strength. And they have been exhibiting relative weakness for much of the last 3 or 4 years. Now, a number of those countries have got expanding middle classes, and that's certainly a strength that they have, but they're also commodity exporters, and of course they have been under enormous pressure because commodity prices have been coming down. So is there a corollary here between the recent relative strength of the mining sector and the stability of some of those ASEAN countries? And that's certainly something that's worth monitoring, and I'll certainly be doing that over the coming weeks and months. What we've also seen this week is that the relative strength in the mining sector has persisted, and then we're not yet out of the woods. The FTSE Mining Index has is in the process of unwinding an oversold condition relative to the 200-day moving average. And certainly a lot of bad news has already been priced in. But it really will need to sustain a move above the 200-day moving average. It will need to find support at progressively higher levels following pullbacks, and we haven't yet had one of those. But what it does suggest is that the mining sector may be leading the metals themselves, and then this is something else that has probably, you know, veteran subscribers will have heard in previous audios over the last couple of years, and it is that a hallmark of the latter stages of a bull market is that the resources sector stages a large recovery, that economics generally tend to improve in the latter stages of an expansion, and the interest rate environment hasn't really put a crimp on that expansion yet, so the commodity sector does better. Well, there's been such an enormous amount of bad news priced into these shares, and they are currently trading at fractions of where their peak values were back in 2011, that then you have to look around and say, well, how many sectors are there that have had these experiences, incredible declines, and potentially represent value? And there aren't that many, and a lot of them are in the resources sector, whether you're looking at energy or basic resources or gold mines. So then they do have the potential to outperform here simply by virtue of the fact that they are so incredibly depressed, and it's an awful lot easier to go from 1 to 2 than it is from $100 to $200 a share. So the mining sector is definitely something that's worth keeping an eye on, but at the same time, we have to think about what does that mean for the medium term. And if this is we are in the latter stages of an expansion, then the turn to outperformance by the resources sector isn't especially good news. It would suggest then that we're going to be in a more difficult environment. Then you have to look at the banking sector, and the bounce that we've seen in a number of US banks is certainly notable, and there is no doubt that the US economy is further along in terms of its recovery than just about anywhere else. And there are some really quite large outstanding problems within the European banking sector, and indeed the Japanese banking sector, and not least because they have they're experiencing negative interest rates at the deposit window. And there's been a lot of really emotional commentary about this, and it is worth just taking a moment to differentiate here that what has been imposed in Japan last week and in Europe last year is a negative interest rate at the deposit window. And that means that banks borrowing to supplement their tier 1 capital, sorry, not the deposit, the discount window, excuse me, have to pay for the privilege. It doesn't necessarily mean that someone who has got a deposit in their bank is going to get a negative interest rate. That hasn't happened yet, and why would you keep your money in the bank if they were charging you to hold it there? You'd be nearly better off putting it under the mattress or buying gold with it. And certainly that is one of the reasons that people are buying gold, because so much debt, and it's upwards of $8 trillion, is currently yielding negative yields. So just by virtue of the fact that gold doesn't pay anything at all, then it has a positive carry. And then gold prices have been really quite steady, that we had this explosive breakout, and now the pullback has been comparatively shallow, and this is perhaps the best of possible worlds from the perspective of a gold bull, in that you have the explosive breakout and a relatively shallow pullback. Well, it was up over $20 yesterday and down $3 in here today, and this continues to look like a consolidation. And silver has a pretty similar pattern. And considering that those are by far the most significant of the monetary metals, then it suggests that then we are, if we haven't already seen the end of what was a four-year bear market, then the evidence pointing toward that conclusion has certainly improved really quite considerably. And a large part of that is because we're in uncharted territory in terms of monetary policy. We simply do not know how this is going to end, because we've never been in an environment where so much debt is in a negative yield environment, and where central banks and an increasing number of central banks are in a negative interest rate environment. So the fact that you have negative interest rates and particularly negative yields is a problem for income investors, because people will buy bonds all day, all week, all year, as long as it's within their mandate, and particularly the mandate for pension funds, because they can justify it that they may not be getting the yield, but they're getting the total return because prices are going up so quickly. But when the yield is negative and you're an income fund, how can you justify buying something that doesn't have a yield? So then that removes a source of potential demand. And I was in the UK 2 weeks ago, and I had to resit the regulatory exam, so I was away from the office yesterday. But one of the things that the regulatory exam in the UK tries to drill into people is that investors have a choice, and that investments have to be appropriate. But central bankers seem to only consider the potential that someone is either spending or saving, and they don't seem to think that there's something in the middle, that you needn't necessarily be a saver. You can just take your money out of the system. And you can take your money out of the system and just sit on it, or you can buy something that is not under the influence of central banks to affect the value of. And in many respects, gold fits that bill. And that helps to contribute to the fact that it has been such a steady consolidation here. And the gold mining sector, relative to the gold price, was at an historic low just before Christmas. And then Newmont Mining is up really quite considerably, and it's one of the best performing shares on the S&P 500 this year. Then, you know, Sibanye Gold is up 300% in just the last 6 weeks. So yes, we are getting a consolidation in the gold mining sector, and there is the potential for a reversion to the mean because they have pushed back above their respective trend means for the first time in 4 years. Then we can look at that and say that's an investment opportunity, but we also have to consider what the ramifications are, that this is a fear trade, that people really are discomforted by the reality that we are in a negative yield environment for maturities on bonds out to 8, 9, even 15 years in the case of Swiss bonds. So if you're a government bond investor buying today, then you're paying central banks for the privilege of taking your money. And there is nobody wants to be in that kind of situation. So we haven't yet seen a major pullback in terms of prices, and not least because we have these negative rates at the deposit window. But it's hard to imagine that we're going to, that the momentum move that we've had in bond prices is going to persist. And one of the only reasons that it would persist is because of additional deleveraging. And the fact that high yield bonds have expanded is problematic because, yes, we've seen that stocks have generally steadied, and the yen might have been strong today, but it's still above its peak. But we haven't really had what you would consider a big move in government or in the high yield sector. So then there hasn't been anything that has really changed how people are really acting there. And when you look at the way that these bonds are moving, we know that it's because there are issues in the energy market, and there is going to be there are going to be bankruptcies, that there was an incredible amount of debt taken out over the last 5 years, and that the ability of companies to refinance that debt is going to be in question when it comes up to be refinanced. And there was very little refinancing had to be done last year. There's a fair amount needs to be done this year, but then it really starts to ramp up next year, the year after, and into 2019. And if companies cannot refinance the amount of debt that they have outstanding at favorable rates, then that's going to have an impact on their ability to continue to buy back shares. It's going to have an impact on their ability to pay dividends and indeed to reinvest in the growth of their company. So then it's perfectly justified that the yield on some of these bonds would be higher, and not least because the average default rate that was considered normal is probably going to get blown out in here. Well, you would have to have a significant improvement and a fair contraction in those yields. And the one that I think perhaps it gives us one of the best illustrations is the FINRA Bloomberg Active High Yield Index, and that's NBBHYL in the chart library. And when one looks at that, and if you were to take the numbers and the name off the chart, you would say that it is a completed base formation, and while a little bit overbought in the short term, that you'd be buying any dip. And if that's the conclusion that one can come to, then the potential is that we are going to see yields higher over the next 6 months, and that it would be you would need to get a lot of countermanding evidence to question that hypothesis. Well, if that's the case, then we often looked at stock markets and said that when the trend eventually rolled over, that we could go into a medium-term correction that could be in terms of its longitude between 1 and 2 years, that after such an impressive breakout from what was a 13-year range, that the S&P could range for a couple of years, and it's already been ranging for a year. Well, this is still a difficult environment, and yes, valuations have improved over the correction to date, and the trailing PE on the index is about a 16 right now. So we're back at reasonable fair value, and let's just say that the S&P goes down a bit further, then valuations will start to get attractive. It means that value investors are already starting to get interested. And it's one of the reasons that, say, a company like, even in the banking sector, Citigroup, Bank of America, and JP Morgan, where they're all trading on single-digit multiples, are beginning to attract attention in here. But then that is not the case for the European banking sector or the Japanese banking sector. There is certainly, the US is much further along in terms of its recovery, and the banking sector has done a better job of writing off bad loans and recapitalizing, so that you have single digit multiples there, and they might be inhibited in terms of how much they can raise their dividends because of the regulatory costs that they now have to bear, but they're in a reasonably healthy shape. And that's just not the case in Europe, because they have done so little to tackle the bad debts that they have, and their answer so far has been to nationalize, and that just saddles the governments with additional debt. So then the banking sector in Europe is still in not the greatest shape, and it still has this potential for additional trouble further down the line. So we're still in the corrective phase, and this could potentially last a while longer. And rather than becoming more bearish, we have to bear in mind that we went through more than a decade of ranging, and a number of those European markets are still ranging. And if you look, for example, at the FTSE 100, it's been ranging for 16 years. Or you look at the Europe Stocks Index, which is SXXP in the chart library, then that's been ranging for over 15 years. So it was Wall Street that broke out, and now we're getting that first step above the base. What are the kinds of things that would help to drive it? Well, the US economy is reaching full employment, and then the decline in energy prices has so far not filtered into the economic statistics very much at all. And of course, the US economy is 70% consumer, so there are a lot more people benefit from low oil prices than there are people that for whom it is a very big problem. Then the US has got this technological advantage, not least because of the entrepreneurship that really is the crown jewel of Silicon Valley. And then because there was the fact that we are further along and that we're 7 years post the credit crisis, that it's a natural time for the economy to begin to be starting to improve again. And you know, statistics today that producer prices are rising and that CPI is above trend. Well, there are a lot of central banks would be delighted if CPI was above 2%, and it isn't within a hair's breadth of that anywhere else. So then when the Fed was talking about the deflationary pressures being transitory, then we're already seeing evidence of that, because wages are rising already. And then the consumer is reaching full employment, and they all have more money in their pockets, and you know, generally speaking, consumers will spend. So then the US exhibits this relative strength, and well, that's a natural reason for why the dollar should be stronger. And the dollar's relative strength was priced in really quite well over the last 6 months, and it has been engaged in this process of mean reversion over the last few months. But it's hard to imagine why the dollar should be getting weaker in here. Then this is nothing more than a consolidation, and it's reasonable to expect that the dollar will be breaking out and doing better over the medium to longer term. And generally speaking, with the preeminence in the stock market, then there's a reason that the US stock market has been comparatively less volatile than elsewhere, and that is because the strength of the currency and the solidity of the market is offers something of a safe haven for people that have to be invested rather than going to cash or owning gold. When we look at the long term, then this is a difficult environment, and there's absolutely no denying that, and that there isn't a great deal of evidence just yet that it's over either. I think it's more likely than not that we can anticipate additional volatility. But then we also know that valuations are improving, and that we are slowly but surely beginning to get over the hump of normalizing interest rates. And the Fed is unlikely to raise interest rates all on its own, but neither are they likely to be cutting interest rates aggressively unless they get a real downturn in economic activity, and that's just not looking likely at the present time. The relative strength of the dollar is a headwind for a lot of people that have been short the dollar, and there were an awful lot of them that had borrowed dollars in the hope of paying it back in their own currency, and they hoped that their currency would go up forever, and that's certainly not the case any longer. And we're still working through that, and this is we're not yet in any kind of shape that we're going to have a period of synchronized economic expansion. The issues that are assailing Europe are existential in nature, and then they're going to come to a head over the next year, where the UK will be voting on whether to stay within the EU or not, and that's going to I think a lot of navel gazing will follow or will come up in anticipation of that vote. And the EU has got some very big decisions to make, and it's a market of 500 million people, and in some of the most wealthy economies in the world. So what happens there really does matter. And what happens in China is equally important, and not least because they have their own problems with debt, and just how they decide to handle them will have a very big impact. And there's no reason that there needs to be a real debt problem in China, because they could extend maturities and they can do a lot of different things to handle the issues that they have. But what is likely is that there's going to be additional rationalization in the resources sector and in building. And they're making an all-out push to support their consumer sector, and that's the sector that's likely to benefit mostly from the kind of reform that we're getting. And if China needs to boost its consumer sector, it's India needs to boost its manufacturing sector, and for a country that doesn't really have one, probably couldn't do it at a better time, where energy prices are low and commodity prices are low. So this is a golden opportunity for India to really grasp the nettle of developing infrastructure. But we need to see evidence of that, because right now the central bank is building up its reserves. In other words, it's selling rupees, and the currency is depreciating, and the stock market is weak as a result. And the fall in energy prices, then what it has highlighted more than anything else is that governance really is everything, and that a commodity bull market papers over a lot of problems in terms of governance, and that you really find out just how much things have deteriorated in terms of governance that was hidden by the spike up in commodity prices. And that's as true of Brazil and Venezuela as it is of much of the Middle East. And the fact that Saudi Arabia and Russia can sit down together and begin to talk about cutting production, well then, that tells us just how much pressure they are under. And it helps to illustrate that we pretty much are close to the low in oil prices, if we haven't already seen it, that prices have gone down enough to pressure supply. And when supply starts getting taken out of the market, then the surpluses that have built up get eroded pretty quickly. Well, oil prices, the Brent crude has already put in a higher reaction low, and as long as it holds that low, then we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to additional upside. And WTI hasn't quite put in a higher reaction low yet. And really, that's not the question. The big question is how far can their prices rally? Because a lot of expected supply, whether that is offshore or whether it's deep water offshore or whether it's tight supply in the form of shale, well, that becomes economic closer to $60 a barrel. So the most likely scenario is that once prices eventually bottom, that they're going to encounter resistance somewhere in the region of $60, and that then we could be in a position where prices range for a considerable period. And natural gas offers a very good template for that, where prices had spiked higher and that encouraged additional supply. That supply hit the market, prices came down, prices fall to a point where they're no longer economic, and then they begin to rise, and they peak at a point where unconventional supply becomes economic once more. So natural gas has been falling for consecutive days, and it's down now to $1.80, and it staged a powerful rally the last time it got down towards these levels. So we can conclude that around this level is where natural gas becomes uneconomic, and up around $2.50 or $3 is where it starts to become economic once more. So then there's the potential here that we're going to get some additional strength in natural gas. So then this isn't a bull market environment. This is a trader's environment. And buy and hold doesn't really work any longer in terms of these commodities. But what we're already seeing is that the relative strength of the majors is exhibiting that they can survive in this environment, and that they're going to be in a very good position because they don't have the kind of sensitivity to low oil prices that some of the more over-leveraged smaller producers do. And that means that it's probably the major companies are going to benefit from this kind of environment, that they're going to be the ones that exhibited the relative strength in terms of their stock performance. And we're seeing that the mining sector is quite similar, that mining and oil are, and energy prices are very tightly intertwined because energy represents such an enormous cost for the mining sector. So falling energy prices have the effect that they keep a lot of marginal supply economic because they're spending less money on energy. So any kind of substantial rally that we get in energy is going to knock out some of that additional supply, and then we can see that some of the bigger companies are already rallying as in response to the steadying in oil prices. And considering just how much they have fallen, then this really is a very big deal indeed. I'm posting a report today from UNICEF, and it's talking about the strides that have been made in providing clean drinking water to 90% of the global population, and that they are really moving on over the next decade to an even more ambitious target of providing sanitation and sanitary conditions for a similar number of people. And if that can be achieved, then that's going to be one of the great foundations for the emergence of Africa as a major economic growth center. And those countries are already growing at a healthy clip, and improving sanitation will only add to that. People that get sick less often can turn up for work and are more productive when they're there, in very, very simple terms. And providing a sanitary environment for people means that they tend to live longer, healthier lives. And eventually running water and a water infrastructure, and that's going to be quite a considerable way away for a lot of people. Well, then that takes out a lot of the drudgery from household labor that particularly women are burdened with. And it's when women can join the economy as active participants, that's generally speaking when economic growth really takes off, and countries seldom look back. And there's plenty of examples of that. So then what happens in terms of water infrastructure in Africa really is a big deal. But Africa's likely to benefit enormously from technology, because not only do we have accelerating technology, but technology now goes instantly global. And that isn't something that happened previously. The kind of technology booms that we've had before were where technology was developed in North America or in Europe and then largely stayed there. And then made its way from Europe to Asia or to Japan primarily and to the US, but the technology stayed in those OECD countries. Whereas it's quite the opposite today, that technology evolves in one place and then goes instantly global. So that countries that are embarking on development now, they get to skip big steps in terms of their economic development. And it means that they get to do it faster. And then that has to happen, and governance has to continue to improve because the falling commodity prices that we've had and the potential that we could be in a very rangy environment for a long time in terms of those commodity prices means that the countries that relied previously on commodity exports have to do everything else better if they're going to really achieve their development goals. And all the trouble that we're having in the Middle East and the hyperinflation that's taking over in Venezuela are simple indications of just how bad the governance was. And you really do need improving governance to drive both economic growth and investor confidence that can drive a bull market. So then you have to consider that things are slowly but surely getting better in India. They're not getting better nearly as quickly as many people would have hoped when Modi was elected. Things are getting better in Indonesia, and that's a major population country. And China is going through a rapid rationalization of its building and resources sectors. There's every reason to expect that they can succeed in transformation. The US is already most of the way through and coming out the other end of what was an incredibly difficult period, and Europe and Japan are lagging, but then they also have, they know what they need to do, and it is only a question then of whether they are willing to do it. But so then when you look at the market and you can say, yes, this is a corrective phase, and there are clear risks out there, but there are also the foundations for a secular bull market. And you know, it's been our contention for quite some time that we need to get over the hump of rationalizing the interest rate environment and getting out of this just incredibly distorting environment that was associated with quantitative easing. And in many respects, the rally that we had from 2010 onwards was liquidity fueled, and we are now rapidly getting an idea of just how much of it was liquidity fueled. And I think perhaps that's the best way to think about the market right now, that the Fed is no longer engaged in quantitative easing, and they have already raised interest rates once. So and their market has pulled back in response to those developments, but not nearly to the same extent that would have been the case if all of that had been done in 2010. So there are fundamental strengths out there in the biggest economy in the world, and that's really quite important. And it means then that any big pullback that we get, that investors should rather be salivating at the potential to acquire attractive assets at reasonable prices rather than becoming progressively more bearish, because the likelihood of a kind of a crash environment really does look unlikely at the current stage. But that is subject to the way that the high yield market evolves, and that's likely to be something that becomes particularly into focus, perhaps not this year, but into next year and the year after. But we'll be guided by what happens in the charts. And, you know, very short term, we're in a consolidation, but medium term, there are overhead top formation characteristics. And that suggests that we are going to have additional volatility going forward. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I wish all the best to all of you.